This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. East Africa has long been considered a hotspot of political instability, and it's heating up again. In recent days, the U.S. has imposed new sanctions against Sudan, and the Prime Minister of Somalia survived an assassination attempt. For this week's Africa Update, NPR's Gwen Tompkins began by explaining new, controversial sanctions against Sudan.
President Bush moved ahead with the sanctions in an effort to pressure the Sudanese government into ending violence in Darfur. Now, these sanctions, they're limited in scope. They freeze the U.S. accounts of some smaller Sudanese companies, and they curb their ability to use dollars. But the sanctions also protect big business. There are big exemptions here, Farai. There's the Chinese oil interests that are exempted from the new sanctions, as well as businesses that that supply other raw materials from Sudan. The sanctions also freeze the U.S. accounts of three Sudanese who are believed to be advancing violence in Darfur. Now, this is Sudan's humanitarian affairs minister, the military intelligence chief, and a rebel leader in Darfur who refused to sign the Darfur peace agreement last year. Andrew Natsios, who's the U.S. special envoy to Sudan, said that the purpose of these sanctions is not sanctions. The purpose is to send a message to the Sudanese government to start behaving differently when they deal with their own people, which essentially means that that the U.S. is aware that this is a slap and not a punch to Sudan.
A slap but not a punch. However, how is this being felt by real people on the ground?
Well, you know, I was recently in Khartoum. This was back in late April, actually. And it was hard to see where the already imposed sanctions have hurt Khartoum. You know, back in 1997, sanctions were slapped on Sudan, and those sanctions have yet to be lifted. You can't use a credit card there because U.S. banks don't do that kind of business with Sudan. But Sudan's burgeoning oil industry has managed to make that country a lot of friends elsewhere. Now, this includes China, India, Malaysia, Indonesia. These are countries with significant business ties to Sudan, and they're in no rush to sanction that government. So you might not be able to buy a GM or a Ford car in Sudan, but you can buy as many Japanese and Korean automobiles as you can afford. I spoke with Sudan's foreign minister before the new sanctions were imposed, and he warned that sanctions will only slow much-needed development in Sudan. As he put it, lack of development is the number one problem that underlies every regional conflict in Sudan. But what he didn't mention, Farai, was that development in the outlying regions of Sudan has been impeded largely by Khartoum, which tends to keep all of that nation's resources in the capital and central areas of the country.
So over the weekend, there were a couple of developments from Somalia. On Friday, a U.S. warship reportedly fired on targets in northern Somalia. What more can you tell us about that situation?
Well, you know, U.S. officials have refused to say much about what happened. Defense Secretary Gates said that this may be an ongoing operation, an anti-terrorist operation, and so he's not at liberty to disclose any information about it. What we have are the remarks of a governor in the semi-autonomous region of Puntland in northern Somalia who says that a warship fired on targets in a remote area of that region. It's believed that terrorists or known terrorists have been encamped there, and it's believed, of course, that the warship fired on those encampments. Now, we don't have any verifiable information about who was hurt or killed in the strike. So as of now, the situation still seems pretty up in the air. But the U.S. has long maintained that terrorists have been living in Somalia. In January, there were U.S. airstrikes against targets in southern Somalia. This was at a time when the U.S. believed that some of the culprits who were responsible for the 1998 bombings of U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania were there. Now, those strikes were considered to be largely unsuccessful because no one on the U.S. list of top known and suspected terrorists was affected.
You know, Gwen, you are so experienced now in covering East Africa, but for most of us, we don't know very much about it. Why are these stories from Somalia and Sudan important?
Well, they're important, Farai, because the U.S. believes, and I shouldn't just say the U.S. believes, that the international community believes that East Africa could be a breeding ground for terrorists who could have some effect on the West and on other areas of the world. Osama bin Laden received help from the Sudanese government back in the 1990s, and as you know, Somalia has not had a government for about 15 years now, so it has really been a state of nature there. So anyone could likely go to Somalia and set up shop there with the most nefarious of interests and be allowed to operate unabettedly. So it's been important for the international community to try to keep an eye on what's going on in this region of the world in East Africa, because so little of this area geographically is under anyone's oversight. You can go to areas of Somalia or Sudan and you can travel for hundreds of miles and you will not see one local authority, for instance. This is an ongoing mystery, what's happening in East Africa, and it's very difficult not only for U.S. governmental interests, but also for all watchers of the area to really get a handle on what's going on, which of course makes everyone feel a little bit more unsettled.
Speaking of unsettled, a suicide bomber reportedly struck in front of the Prime Minister's house in Mogadishu, Somalia. Does anyone know who planned that explosion?
Any number of agents could have been behind the attack over the weekend, Farai. Essentially, the transitional government in Somalia, which is still fighting to gain control over that country, as well as Prime Minister Getty, they've got an awful lot of enemies. They've got enemies from the outside in terms of perhaps those who are sympathetic with the Islamic Courts Union, who used to control Mogadishu. These agents might be acting against the transitional government in the form of an insurgency that they've likened to the insurgency in Iraq. There are also domestic tensions on the ground, specifically the clans, who really have very little to say to the Prime Minister. Most specifically, his own clan, the Huia, who were the dominant clan of the Islamic Courts Union, and who are the most militarily supported of all the clans. They're the strongest, they're the most powerful, and unfortunately, they don't seem to have much regard for the Prime Minister.
Well, Gwen, that seems like a lot of serious bad news in one week.
Well, you're right, Farai. It does seem like an awful lot of bad news, but there have been other reports that are a little bit more encouraging. Here in Kenya, reports are showing 6.1% growth in the GDP, which is phenomenal. I mean, this economy is growing at a rate that that it hasn't grown at since the 1970s, and in large part, it's believed that tourism has been the engine behind this kind of growth. Tourism in the form of conferences, conferees, staying a few extra days, going on safari here, looking at other sites. Now, this is at a time when there are travel advisories against Kenya, where Westerners have been discouraged from visiting, but Westerners are still coming, and they've come in large part to see what has been called the eighth wonder of the world, which is the great migration of the wildebeest. In fact, now, June, July, and August, 1 million wildebeest are expected to come from Tanzania into Kenya to graze for a few months and then head right back on home.
Gwen, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Farai.
NPR Africa correspondent Gwen Tompkins joined us from Nairobi.